Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. December is a busy time of year for people. Exam time, end of the year time, holiday time, trying to fit in a lot of things. People are even getting married at this time of year. Lots of things happening. Babies are being born. It's a very full schedule. And traditionally at this time of year, I always remember the enlightened nuns that have been the forerunners of the nuns of today. Because this is the time when traditionally we remember that on the full moon of December, the Arahant nun Sanghamitta Teri brought the Bodhi tree sapling from India to Sri Lanka, and that was a sapling of the tree under which the Buddha became enlightened, and that sapling was planted and is still alive today. And not only that, Sanghamitta Teri also brought the ordination lineage of nuns from India to Sri Lanka. So that was the first time that the ordination moved outside the territory of India where the Buddha was, where he gave his teachings, where he lived his life, to Sri Lanka. And then from Sri Lanka out into the world. So this is a time when each year I try to mention some stories connected with the enlightened nuns of the time of the Buddha. And there are many stories of the enlightened nuns from the time of the Buddha, and we have them available to us to read not only in the suttas but in a special collection of the verses of the enlightened nuns called the Teri Gatha. And these are the verses which the nuns composed after their enlightenment. Some of these verses talk about their life story, an incident that led them to renounce the world and ordain as a nun, or the particular teaching that they heard and that they used for their practice. But tonight I thought, instead of talking about one of the teachings from the past, I would give a teaching which I've heard from a nun who's teaching at the present. And it's very important for us to recognize that not only were there enlightened nuns in the time of the Buddha, that there are many nuns today who are practicing. And although I'm not claiming that the nun whose teaching I'm going to give tonight is an enlightened nun, I'm not in a position to judge that, but I'm sure she wouldn't claim that. She claims herself to be just a student. But I think it's very important for us to understand and realise that although we see mostly monks teaching the Buddha's teaching, that there are thousands of nuns also living the holy life throughout the world, not only in the Theravada tradition, but in the Mahayana tradition and the Tibetan tradition as well. And one of the reasons why it's important for us to recognise this and be aware of it is because it makes an impact on our perception of who are the torchbearers, who are the lineage holders, who are the daughters and the sons of the Buddha. If we only see monks teaching, or if we see nuns very rarely, we can have the perception that it's only for a select group, mostly for the monks. And we may have not even realized that there were female monastics practicing today. And this has an impact on the minds of everyone, male and female, who look and see what role models do we have that we can emulate, that we can follow. If women only see monks teaching, or they only see males teaching, then the perception can arise that females can't do this, they can't live this life, they can't get enlightened, the practice isn't for me. And so it's very important to remind all of us that that's not the case. The Buddha said unequivocally that women have the same spiritual capacity as men, the same capacity to attain enlightenment, and this path of practice is for all of us. And the other thing that we have to realize is that all of us have been, both men and women, male and female, through countless lifetimes, over many births, we've had both kinds of bodies, been both kind of genders. So we are in this incarnation, in this body, in this social role of this gender, but that is just a part of conditioned experience. It's not our absolute reality. To give a very prosaic example of why it's so important that we realize that we all have this potential and that we have role models who show us what is the range of this of the potential that we have, I'd like to remind you of a movie that appeared in the cinemas a few years ago. It was about a little boy. I think the title of the movie was Billy Elliot, if I'm not incorrect. It was about a boy who wanted to be a dancer, a ballet dancer. He loved dancing, but his father, not realizing that and not really approving of it, sent him to learn to box. So every Saturday he had to go to boxing lessons. But the dance classes were held just next door, and so he used to slip into the dance classes and learn ballet. And it wasn't until he'd become so good at it that he was going to go for a scholarship somewhere that his family found out that instead of pursuing a boxing career or pastime, he was actually dancing. And no one had ever done that in their family. And was that a good thing for boys to be doing? Was it really manly or acceptable? And so in this movie, the theme of the movie was to show that it was all right to be a dancer and that boys could be dancers too. And if they were given the chance, they could be a star. And so at the end of the movie, we see that this young boy has been able to pursue his dream. And after years of training, to become a featured dancer in the ballet. Now, very interestingly, this last year has been the first year in the history of the Royal Ballet at Covent Garden that they have had more male applicants for the dancing school than female applicants. And the result of this movie is to make it okay for boys to pursue their dream of being ballet dancers or dancers. It's no longer a females only profession. And the first time in the history of this dancing school, this prestigious dancing school, the number of male applicants have exceeded the number of female applicants. And this is a very telling result of the fact of this movie making something that was considered to be only for a select group or not possible for some people, to make that a possibility. And having made that a possibility, to actually change the situation, because now instead of having most scholarships for females and never having enough males to dance in ballets, the whole thing is being turned around. I wonder if they've got enough changing rooms for the males. Now they used to have only mostly females. Do they have enough roles in the ballets for the males, the number of males who want to take up the positions in the dancing companies? We can see the flow-on effect. So the point I'm making is that unless we get the message out there that it's all right and we allow people to live their dreams, we're never going to really provide what is asked for, what is wished for, and that is the opportunity to, in this case, be a ballet dancer, but in the case of those of us who have gone forth, to live the monastic life. Here in Perth, we're very fortunate that we have wonderful conditions, probably the best conditions in the world for female monastics, with very good monastery to live in, wonderful support from lay people, which is not only generous in its material support, but is also very generous and respectful in valuing what... Could you please turn that off, whoever's got their mobile phone on, please? Thank you. Also valuing what we do as monastics and giving the female monastics the same opportunities as the males. So tonight I thought I would pass on a teaching which I've received from a nun who's teaching today. She teaches in the Tibetan tradition and her name is Venerable Pema Chodron. And she is the head of a monastery in North America, which is one of the very few training monasteries for Western monks and nuns. Both monks and nuns train together in this particular monastery. The monastery is in Nova Scotia in Canada, and it's called Gumpo Abbey. And she is the director. And her teachings are available on CD and on DVD. And it's wonderful to have the teachings from someone who's been living the holy life for over 30 years. She's ordained as a bhikkhuni. And she's been teaching worldwide for many years, teaching both retreats and also giving public talks and also training monastics. Now in this particular teaching that she's given, it's a preliminary teaching for a particular kind of meditation practice. And this preliminary practice is a very simple and straightforward one, but it has many benefits for us on many levels, and it leads on to the meditation practice, which I'll describe. These preliminary practices have two aspects to them. One, but both have the same purpose, and that is to help us to open our hearts to others and to see what we share as human beings and to feel our connectedness with others. Not only to feel our connectedness with others, but also to help to break down the sense of isolation or specialness that we often feel about ourselves. The first of these practices is when we get into a difficult situation or into a bad mood or into something that we don't like, a mood that we don't like. What we'd say is a negative mind state. It might be that we're feeling irritated or we might be feeling lonely or we might be feeling confused and don't know what to do in a particular situation. And at that time, if you can just put yourself in that kind of situation, we often do close off from others. We often do feel like we're the only one who's got to do this. Why has this got to happen again? Why is this happening to me? No one else knows what it's like to be in this situation. And we sort of shrink and get smaller and harder around our feelings at that time. And so the practice is to be mindful of that. When we realize what we do at that time and that it's not actually pleasant and not very helpful, then through mindfulness we recognize what's happening, and in that moment we turn it around and we remind ourselves that right at this moment in the world there must be millions of people who are feeling just like I'm feeling, irritated or lonely or don't know what to do. And in the moment that we can recognize millions of people just like me, we start to open up. We start to recognize nothing special. This is what being a human being contains. And that immediately helps to soften our heart and strangely to lighten our own burden. When we think we're carrying all this all on our own, it gets really heavy, but when we start to open up and open out and to connect to those millions of people right now who are going through exactly what I'm going through, there's a sense of relief. And we might even think, you know, throughout the course of history, there's probably been millions of people in the boat that I'm in right now, in the state that I'm in right now. Whichever of those two things helps you to see that you're not the only one. And from that point of opening up and opening out, we may even be able to generate a feeling of compassion. May I be free of this suffering, and may all beings who are in the same boat as I'm in, feeling the same thing right now, may they find a way out of their suffering. And so we generate a feeling of compassion, and this feeling of compassion is a wholesome mind state which cuts through the negativity. The negativity which actually undermines our ability to cope well with whatever it is we're dealing with. When we have some compassion, we generate some energy, we generate some light in the mind. It helps us to actually address what we've got to deal with much more skillfully. So it's not only benefit for others, it's benefit for ourselves. And to get this benefit, it's not enough just to do this once or every now and again, but if we can make it a practice that we try to develop again and again. First of all, it helps us to be mindful, to pay attention to what we're doing, how we're feeling, and the consequences of it. That closing off, that shutting down, that feeling of isolation. And then in that moment, it strengthens that power to turn it around and to open up and to wish well for ourselves and for others as well. And it links us to everyone else in the world. We start to see this is a human experience. And also to see that it doesn't last. It's impermanent. When we start to generate that feeling of wishing someone else may be free, we've already stepped away from our isolation, our self-centeredness, and very often the emotion that was holding us down at that time. So this is the first of these preliminary practices. The second of the preliminary practices is, if you like, the opposite, is to try to connect with others when we're in the middle of something pleasant. And again, we need to be mindful to notice that we're just in the middle of something nice. And particularly in this practice, we notice when we experience anything through any of the sense doors, and that sense contact, seeing something with the eye, hearing something with the ear, smelling something with the nose, tasting something with the tongue, feeling something with the body, or thinking about something with the mind. When we have an experience and it brings happiness, delight, pleasant feeling into the mind, At that moment, we notice it, we're aware of it. With our mindfulness, we're right on the spot. And we recognize this feeling has been produced through contact, through any of the sense doors. And we, at that moment, don't keep that pleasant feeling to ourselves. At that moment, we open our heart, we open our mind, and wish, make the offering of this happiness, this pleasant feeling, to someone else. And in this particular practice, the traditional people that we offer this to is our teachers or our parents or to someone that we want to show our gratitude. And it's not that we're offering something material, it's not something we can pick up and carry to that person. It's a mind offering. It all happens in the mind. That feeling of happiness arises and we don't keep it to ourselves. We bring someone else into our mind and we share that feeling with them. I offer this feeling of happiness to my parents. May they experience this kind of happiness. And again, we start to recognize how the cause and effect relationship is arising. Something produces an effect in us, and that becomes the cause for offering something, producing an effect, not with someone else, with ourselves. That opening up, that opening out, that sharing. And as we share good things, we actually get more of them. That is, at that moment, instead of losing the happiness, when we connect with someone that we would really like to express our gratitude, our love, our care to, that feeling of happiness, pleasure, actually increases. And so we see again that what we do for others is actually beneficial for ourselves. Again, unless we practice this regularly, unless we determine that we're going to be mindful and try to notice how seeing something makes us feel happy, hearing something makes us joyful, then we are not going to notice when those moments come along. And sometimes they are just moments during the day. But it's the nature of the mind that we very often don't pay them any attention and we don't appreciate them. We don't get their full worth. And so at the end of the day, we might even say, oh, I've had a miserable day today, nothing went right. But we failed to notice there were many moments during the day that were actually very right, that were very pleasant. They maybe didn't last, but then what does? But while they were there, we made the most of them for our own sake and for the sake of others. And as we accumulate more and more of these moments throughout the day, we'll start to change our perceptions around. It wasn't such a bad day after all. It was one of those mixed days instead of just, oh, terrible day. And that again helps us to bring more energy into the mind to face whatever it is that we have to deal with. These two preliminary practices are preliminaries for a particular kind of meditation practice. This is in the Tibetan tradition called the Tonglen practice. And in this particular meditation practice, what we are training the mind or the heart to be able to do is to open up to the suffering of others in the world. Many of you would be familiar with the practice of sending out loving kindness and wishing others well, which is what we did in the meditation. First of all, wishing ourselves well, making peace with ourselves, and then spreading those good wishes to all beings everywhere. That's a foundation for the practice of being able to consciously take in the suffering of other beings. Now, I don't pretend that I'm going to teach the full practice here. I'm just introducing you to it. But to see that any practice that we are going to work up to, any meditation practice, is part of a gradual training, and we need to have the preliminary practices under our belt. We need to do the foundation work first, and then we can move up to something which seems extraordinary. And it is extraordinary if you think how much of our time is spent trying to avoid pain and suffering, trying to turn off from the things that we don't like, our own pain and suffering, and the pain and suffering of others. And this practice is actually taking us right towards that pain and suffering, because in this Tonglen meditation practice, after we've established our mind in peacefulness, in happiness, in loving kindness, then we consciously open up our heart and our mind to all the suffering in the world, or to the suffering of particular people, particular groups of people, maybe all the people who are lonely right now. And in the meditation practice, we use the breath and we breathe in consciously, in and out, until we're very clear of the breath coming in and out. And then we move the focus of our attention down to the middle of our chest, to the heart center. And we breathe in and out through the heart, so that we're connecting with the world through our heart. And just as in loving kindness we send out loving wishes to the world, in this Tonglen practice, after we breathe out loving wishes, then we imagine that we're opening up our heart to breathe, and as we breathe in, we're receiving all the suffering in the world. And as we breathe out, we're breathing out freedom from suffering, peace. If we're breathing in the suffering of everyone who's lonely right at this moment, we breathe out friendship, care, concern. What would make lonely people feel less lonely? Now, one of the important aspects of this practice, and why the preliminary practices are part of the gradual training which prepares the mind for this work, is that when we breathe out what would make a lonely person feel less lonely, the most effective way we can do that is if we remember what it feels like ourselves to feel lonely. We use our own experience of suffering to help us connect to the suffering of others. Now, in the preliminary practices, when we're feeling miserable, we remind ourselves other people feel miserable. When we're feeling lonely, we remind ourselves that other people feel lonely. When we're feeling depressed or confused or angry or whatever it is, we remind ourselves that other people in the world right now are feeling like this too. But we don't use that as a way of avoiding our own suffering. What this is helping us to do is to be in touch with what it feels like when you're lonely. What would be helpful? What helps me when I'm lonely? How can I know what would help someone else if I don't know what would help me, if I can't bear to look at my own loneliness or my own depression or my own anger or whatever it is that we find that keeps coming up again and again? So the preliminary practices, because we're using mindfulness to know what's going on, we start to be able to get a closer view, to be more sensitive, to stay with that feeling. And realizing we're not the only one who feels that, to realize that we are connecting with others, helps us to stay with our own suffering, to get to know it. And part of getting to know it is to see what brings it about, how it feels while we're in the middle of it, and that it doesn't last, it also passes away. If we know that experientially, if we know that from the inside out, then when we're wishing that someone else may be free of suffering, may be free of loneliness, we know how it feels and we know what would help. And in this meditation practice, again, we don't just do it once and think that we've done enough. We have to keep doing it, repeating it, noticing as we do it where we close off, where we resist, how we don't like it. Very often the idea comes into the mind, gee, if I open up to suffering, I'm going to be more depressed, I'm going to be overwhelmed. What's the point of that? And that's why we do the balancing practices of noticing what we've got in our life that's wonderful, what we've got in our life to celebrate, and how we can make that grow by actively offering it to others, even if only mentally. And we all know, according to the Buddha's teaching, and we again test it out for ourselves, that what starts in the mind gives rise to speech and action. And so if we start to cultivate this sense of wanting to share what we've got that's good and wanting to help when something is miserable, when we're feeling something difficult, then it might motivate us to go and do something, to actually help someone else, to actually give a portion of the good things that we've got in our life. And as we do that, we make the mind even stronger, make the mind more buoyant, more energetic, so that we can cope with the difficulties that we have to face in life, and we can bear to face the suffering that we have and also to open to the suffering of others. As I said when I was talking about the preliminary practices, loving kindness practice developed and cultivated, loving kindness to ourselves, wishing ourselves well, knowing what's for our own true happiness. This helps to provide a basis for looking at the suffering in our own lives as well as the suffering in the lives of others. And as we cultivate these things in meditation, it helps us to come back into our daily life and to meet our own suffering and to meet the suffering of others without needing to run away, and also with a depth of wisdom and compassion which helps us to recognize that very often we don't have a solution to someone else's problem. What we discover as we become more familiar with our own suffering and become more familiar with its texture, with its tone, with the way it comes about, with how it feels, with what makes it change, we recognize that there are some things in our life that we can't get rid of, even if we don't like them. We have to learn to bear with them. Or there are some things in our life that will change, but not just through what we do. We have to wait for time to pass. We have to wait for other people to do something. There are many situations where we recognize that it's not a good situation, but it's impossible just to get it out of the way. We have to learn to open to it, to be patient with it, to accept it, to bear with it. And one of the most useful things that we can do for ourselves and for others who are suffering is to just be present, to listen in that person's suffering, to that person's suffering, without expecting of ourselves that we're going to be able to come up with a solution to their problems. Because this very often makes us afraid to come in contact with people who are suffering. We feel either we should have an answer, and if we can't, there's no point. Or we feel guilty because we don't have the same problem that they've got. Or we feel somehow not good enough because we can't find an answer to their problem. And if we have become more familiar with our own suffering and start to really know what that's like, then it helps us to be with people who are going through a painful time without the expectation that we're going to be able to take away their suffering. But we can offer them our wholehearted presence, our compassion, our loving kindness, our wish for them that they may be free of suffering, and our wish that we may be able to do for them what they feel would be helpful for them. I'll give you an example of how this kind of training and this kind of practice can actually be very useful even in the most difficult circumstances. Just recently I was contacted by a family whose child had been murdered. And the family were asking, what can we possibly do to help the parents in this situation? What can we possibly say to bring any comfort? And out of love and care, wanting to do something for these parents. And so the first thing is to acknowledge just what a tragic, terrible situation it is. Very often we think as Buddhists we should be equanimous to anything that comes along, and we shouldn't show that we're upset by anything, and so we feel that we have to somehow look away from what is truly a tragedy. We have to really feel what it's like. And this is where our training, our practice comes in to help us. Just imagine to be in that situation. Of course, extreme pain, grief. So acknowledging, yes, it's tragedy, it's very, very painful. And that I don't know what to say. I just don't know what to say. I just feel so sorry, so sad. Just to say that, acknowledging their grief, maybe not even having to say it, just wordlessly being there. Not trying to comfort them in the sense of making it go away, because when you think about this kind of situation, you realize how stupid it is to try and think that we're going to make the problem go away, that we're going to make their pain go away, that there's going to be something we can say that's going to make them feel better. So acknowledging and then listening. Listening to what they have to say. And in a situation like that, in such a traumatic experience, there will be all sorts of different emotions coming up. Grief, sadness, anger, guilt, blame, all of those things. And to be able to express that, to have someone listen to that without making a judgment, or you shouldn't say that, don't think like that, well, that's not a good thing. Just to listen, just to be there, just to be fully present with those people. And how to do that if we haven't been fully present with our own suffering? Because it's coming from our own experience of suffering. Even if we've never experienced something as terrible as that someone we love has been murdered, we know what it's like to lose what's dear to us. We know what it's like to have things go out of control. Sometimes it's a feeling that everything's gone out of control. How did this happen? I did all the right things and it didn't come out the way that I expected. So we find what is common in that experience, what touches us, truly touches us in our own experience. And if we don't have any sense of common ground, then we don't try and artificially say, oh, I know just how you feel, when we might say, I've never had to experience that, so I can only just imagine how you might be feeling. I've never been through that myself. So in this kind of situation, it's a very good example of how when we face suffering in the world, we may not be able to solve that problem or take away that pain. We may have to learn to bear with it, to learn to bear with it and accept that this is how it is now, but that it will change. And we have to be patient, and we have to be there, and we have to stay with it. If we haven't learned to stay with our own suffering, if we haven't learned to be patient with our own fears, our own unhappiness, if we haven't been able to be compassionate with ourselves, then it's more difficult to be compassionate with others. And the more that we can be present with ourselves, the more that we can be compassionate to ourselves, that much more we'll be able to be there for others. So you see, this particular teaching given by this Tibetan nun, Venerable Pema Chodron, is a teaching like all the Buddha's teaching, which is of benefit to ourselves and then is of benefit to others. And as it's of benefit to others, that benefit flows back to ourselves. We start to realize the truth of the Buddha's teaching that we're all connected, that we affect each other, that we don't live independently and in isolation, even though sometimes we feel isolated and we feel like we're the only one. Actually, whatever we're feeling, whatever we're experiencing, it's all part of the human condition, and we can be sure that someone somewhere at some time has been experiencing what we're experiencing, has been feeling what we're feeling, and that that connection with others is something that actually helps to lighten the load that we feel that we're carrying. It helps to break down that sense of isolation, and it helps to see our interconnectedness. So I encourage all of you to take a look at these teachings, and particularly tonight I've offered them because they are the teachings which I've heard from one of the nuns who lives in the world at the moment. But to realise that all these teachings come from the Buddha on direct transmission from generation to generation, and that we're very fortunate to have these teachings available to us in this day and age for our own sake and for the sake of the world that we all share. So may this teaching be of benefit to everyone, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana.
Arahan Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhan Bhagavantan Abhivadeni Swakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghaṃ